Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KCI FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guests are literary agent Adam Cromie and author Diana Abu-Jabbar. First, we're going to bring on Adam Cromie. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for having me.
Oh, great to have you. Will you talk a bit about finding your way to agenting?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about that as I heard the promos for your show. being a frustrated writer myself, I guess, led me to being a literary agent. I had had a successful career in the technology field for almost 10 years, starting from when I was still a student at NYU Stern School of Business. And after about 9 or 10 years of working in the computer business, I was really longing for a more creative life and lifestyle. So I sold out the share of my computer company to my partner and tried to embark on a writing career. I took screenwriting classes and some film classes at NYU and felt that I was going to be able to do that for a living. And I very soon realized that it's a very tough business as a writer. And as I gradually progressed, I started to realize that I was making more phone calls and pitching my work more than I was doing revisions of the screenplays I was writing. And I started to think that maybe I should be in a creative field, but maybe more on the business side of things. So I took a job at a literary agency thinking it might hold me over until my big break as a writer. But as I got there, I started to realize that this was indeed my calling and that I'm a good enough writer to recognize writing from others and hopefully help develop other people's writing, but I really enjoy the entrepreneurial nature of being an agent and the wheeling and dealing and negotiating, and I like handling the business part of writers' careers so that they can focus on the creative part, and it's gone very well, so I'm very happy to have found this.
Talk about the sorts of stuff you represent and how it might be divided up between fiction and nonfiction.
Well, the industry is changing, and I find that my list, even in 5 years, has changed substantially. I originally thought that I would be doing about half fiction and half nonfiction, and I read more fiction than nonfiction when I was a casual reader or just a consumer of books. So I thought my representation would be that way as well. But as I started to become an agent and sell books, I realized that selling nonfiction was easier than selling fiction. And since I became an agent 5 years ago, the market trends have made that difference between nonfiction and fiction even more substantial. And now I'm doing about two-thirds nonfiction for every one-third of every third that I'm doing in fiction. And we basically end up we only represent stuff we like. So I represent nonfiction projects that I really love, but we really pay the rent with nonfiction, and we represent the novels because we love them.
Mm-hmm. So does it figure then that what comes in the door is influenced by whether it's fiction or nonfiction? What I mean to say is, do you need to have a different reaction to the fiction that comes in than to the nonfiction? Do you need to love it more? Do you need to be thrilled, whereas with nonfiction, perhaps you like it, but you can see its marketability? Do you have different reactions to
both? I have to further distinguish, even within nonfiction, that practical nonfiction I can sell very reliably because it's largely based on the author's platform and notoriety as a expert in a certain field. So if I have an expert with an established track record in a certain area of expertise, I have maybe a 90% success rate of selling the proposal. So as long as I like it, I know that the time I invest in it is going to pay off because it's so reliable when it comes to selling. Mm-hmm. Narrative nonfiction is almost as hard to sell as fiction if the authors don't have an established platform. If the person's writing for the New York Times or the New Yorker, their nonfiction sells pretty reliably, but as a young agent starting out, it's hard to sign those people. So if you're working with journalists who don't have quite a track record, or even perhaps somebody who has written a memoir about a unique experience, that kind of narrative nonfiction is still pretty hard to sell, though maybe a little bit easier than novels. And then finally, novels are quite hard to sell, and you don't always get a big advance either. I take on a novelist usually because they have potential for a long-term career. You may take on a genre writer because you think they could grow into a name-brand writer someday, or you take on a literary fiction writer hoping that they're writing important, good books that will last and maybe bring some prestige to the author and yourself, if not money eventually.
But
I would say those are the three ways that I distinguish the books I look at.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm here today with Adam Cromie, who is a literary agent in New York, and he has a website, which is... Tell us.
Oh, yeah, I have the longest URL. artistsandartisans.com. So artistsandartisans.com. And if they Google my name, I think my website's the first thing that comes up. It's Adam Cromie.
Oh, my gosh, no way!
Adam Cromie, C-H-R-O-M-Y.
Okay, great. How about how you get involved with material? Somebody sends you a query letter, whether it be for a novel or for a nonfiction project, and on the basis of the query letter, I imagine you either want to see more or you don't.
Yes, I get a large volume of query letters, and I go through most of them, if not all of them myself, at least to give it one quick glance. And I also have an intern, and I have two other agents who haven't been agenting as long as me, so they have more time to spend looking at samples, and they're hungrier for new clients. So at least 2 to 4 people look over most of the queries that come through our office. I'm fortunate enough to be at a stage in my career where a lot of my clients come on word of mouth or referrals from other clients, or if I have lunch with an editor who's interested in a particular subject matter, or I perhaps may conceive of a story that I think is worthy of a book, I will often approach people that I see in the media, or I approach experts in the field and try to convince them that they should do a book on the subject. And so I've been doing fairly well with that kind of work. And I also have the second and third books of the clients whose books I sold 3 years ago or 4 years ago. So that fills up my list pretty well. I think it's good to mention to authors that it's worth looking at working with agents, assistants, or associate agents. You don't always want to pick an agent because of their seniority. If your book is a mid-list book or it's a solid book, but it's not maybe a six-figure deal that's going to attract a senior agent's attention, the young agents who are still building their list and still trying to make a name for themselves is probably a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that's how Carl Hyacin was discovered. I read a story about him that his query and manuscripts were read by the agent's assistant, and the agent's assistant loved it and asked her boss to let her represent it, and she took it on as one of her early clients, if not her first, and he's still with her now, and I imagine most people will know he's had a really great career.
Excellent career. Yeah, that's so true, because so often when people are looking for an agent the first time, they're looking at the biggest names they can find instead of thinking this way, that maybe the agents who are starting up could be, you know, really good options.
Yeah, I still find myself taking advantage of that. I have a 3-agent company, and I've only been doing this for 5 years, and I let people know that if they go to a really big agency, I don't want to mention any specifically, but if they go to the very top-tier agencies, I'm sure they get good representation, but maybe not. They may not be a VIP or a number one A client there, but at my agency, some people who might be B or C list at the best agencies in the world can be, very well be an A client for me, and they get really good attention for that.
Now, in terms of size of agency, do you want to keep it smaller so that it's more in touch with the client? Or, I mean, can you see just, you know, growing and growing until, you know, you're just massive? I mean, what is your goal as an agent, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Well, I think that there's a certain size of an agency that works very efficiently, and I think maybe 5 or 6 agents is a good number. We're 3 now, so we'll definitely look to double in the next few years. And but once we reach that number, I think we'll probably, most of our expansion will come from providing more services to our clients. We're We're on the verge of having a few of our books made into films, which we'll be really excited. So I'm looking to expand our capability for handling our clients' performance rights. With 5 or 6 agents, we could probably do more of our own foreign rights. We sub-agent that out now, but with several agents, you could have your own foreign rights person, that kind of thing. So I think that there probably is an optimal size for an agency, and we're getting there. But again, most people choose their agent based on their personality and the match for their career rather than the agency size. So I don't think it's held us back at all.
Yeah,
it's just something that I would like to do in the future. The other thing is I really am trying not to let people think of us as a literary agency that sells books. I feel like that's like saying that the companies that used to say they were in a railroad business that went bankrupt because they didn't realize they were in a transportation industry. And when the world changed, I guess a century ago or about that time, I like to think of myself as selling intellectual property of writers or people who create intellectual property. And even if books cease to exist, I would still be selling their intellectual property through a subscription to email services or pushing content to cell phones or selling TV shows or movies if people don't read books anymore. So I feel part of our expansion is really expanding our capability to sell our clients' messages through the web, through television, through other media, not just books.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I wonder if you have any opinions on authors getting more and more involved with places like MySpace.com, where, you know, it used to be that MySpace.com was not the place for authors, and more they're there. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think that that trend is only going to continue. The social networking is a really great way for people to congregate with like-minded folks. I think it's a great trend, and I am encouraging my authors to think more about how that could fit. The great thing about the internet is that it's a great congregator of like-minded people. If you wrote a book on beekeeping, for instance, I mentioned that because I'm reading a magazine article in the New Yorker about the bees that are all dying across the country. Fascinating. But if you wrote a book about beekeeping, and you went on a national book tour, and you went to libraries or bookstores across the country, maybe each town has a couple of people particularly interested in bees. And if it rained that day or something else were going on in that town, you won't have anybody at your reading. But if you start a website and or use MySpace and use the search capability where you can find people that are interested in beekeeping, you could have direct access to the 30,000 people in the country that are rabidly interested in the subject.
Yes.
And then you could have a dialogue with them. You could certainly let them know the book is available. You could be part of the dialogue that these people have, and it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to fly around, and you don't have to talk to them two at a time. You speak with them. You could speak to all 30,000 of them all at the same time. And I think that's what MySpace does. It lets you reach those people without physically going on a scavenger hunt to find them.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Oh, well, you're listening to Writer's Own Writing here on 88.9 FM, KUCI, and I am with Adam Cromie, a literary agent in New York City. Getting back to that query letter coming in and then deciding whether or not you want to see more. Okay, so whether it's a novel and they send you 50 pages or more, or a book proposal, and they send you the entire proposal plus a couple of chapters, how much do you need to read before you know whether it's something that's appealing to you? And do you get a good enough sense from the query letter to feel pretty confident that once the material comes in, it's going to be what you think it is?
Well, this I've had some fun with this at the ASJA
yes.
conferences on the so-called American Idol panel, where we give our comments to the first pages of proposals or manuscripts. But I think being an agent requires you to have a gut, or a confidence in your gut feeling. As soon as I read something, I know if I'm interested or not, and I don't spend a lot of time second-guessing myself. With 1,000 queries a week passing my desk, if I gave 2 or 3 thoughts to every query, I would never get the work done for the clients I already have. So, and my primary job is to service my clients. It's not to fairly consider all the queries in the world that are coming into my office. And I think sometimes I see on writers' boards on the internet, or perhaps even I've been criticized in certain parlors for being brusque or quick. And writers say, "Oh, we deserve something," and or something might be fair or required. And my only obligation is to do a good job for the clients I already have. Mm-hmm. The fact that I look at new queries, that's something I do because I'm looking for new clients. But I do it for purely selfish reasons, and any thought on the querier's part that this is some fair or reasonable technique is just a disillusionment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that I look at things to see if I'm interested, and generally a high concept or premise that sounds fresh or new is good for me. There's a way to articulate a story to make the concept or conflict of a story feel vital and alive and interesting. That I think if you're a good writer and you're a good storyteller and you're a good promoter, you probably know how to do that. And if you're not, if you can't fashion a good query letter, chances are you can't fashion a great novel. So I don't give much time to certain queries. But there are queries that come in that are quite casually worded. They're rough and maybe even have a spelling mistake or a grammatical error, but they're so they have this quality that just grabs you. It's like, you know, the rough raconteur at a party that you just, you know, he's dirty and, you know, kind of rough, but you just, everybody's riveted by them. Like, those queries come in too, so it's not about just being correct, and it's not about being neat. It's about whether it grabs me or not. And if it grabs me, I'll read more. And if there are a lot of rough ones that I find that the writing is rough too, so I pass on it. But at least I gave it a look. If it's neat, that's great. But it still has to have. It can't just be correct. It also has to be vital and grabbing.
Mm-hmm. So. And will you read on and on once you get those pages? You say you've gotten 3 chapters of a novel from someone. And, I've heard agents say they'll read a paragraph and know whether they want to read on. They'll read to the second page and maybe want to read on, maybe not. And when writers hear this, they are appalled that someone wouldn't take the time to read all 3 chapters.
Yeah, I know that, I don't read more than a paragraph if I don't like something. Again, I don't feel like I have any obligation to read any more than that. I bring American Idol up again. If you watch the tryouts for the show, like somebody who is a good judge of musicianship or a good judge of vocal ability knows as soon as the person opens their mouth whether they can sing or not.
Yes.
And The thing I know that I look for, and I think other agents look for when they read submissions, is voice. The writing voice is critical. It has to be the personality of the writing has to be many things. It has to be enjoyable to read. It has to be easy to read, and it should at least be unique. It should be unique if it's literary. To feel like there's personality, and this is a new personality. This is somebody I want to spend 12 hours reading a book with. And if it's a genre book, it should at least be serviceable without being overly adorned.
Mm-hmm.
And the voice cannot be faked. You can't start writing. Well, some people just write really well naturally, but if you have a rough writing style, it doesn't matter how great the storyline is. I can't read it. I can't read it. I can't reread sentences. I can't go back and say, "Oh, what were they trying to say here? Oh, wow, this another run-on. I can't. What are they saying?"
Mm-hmm.
If I'm stumbling over the first paragraph, I don't need to read 300 pages of that to know the book is a pass.
Mm-hmm.
And there are good writers who maybe are too early in their career trying to find agents where the voice isn't refined or isn't defined yet, or maybe those people will never have good voice. But the first thing that I look for is a good and interesting voice, and I know right away whether I want to keep reading or not. And I don't represent anything just because I think it's going to make money. I have to be able to read it. I have to be able to probably read it more than once. I read it, I give notes, I reread it, then I maybe reread it again. Then I try to sell it to an editor. Then the editor gives notes, and then I probably reread the last draft of the manuscript, something I'm going to have to read several times. If I don't like the personality of the writing, I'm not going to be able to give that person good service, and I'm not going to be able to stick with them for a career. I can't have my assistants read the book or anything like that.
Yeah, is it different? Is the voice element different at all for nonfiction, for say prescriptive nonfiction, self-help, those kind of books, or is it sort of similar?
Well, can I just say one last thing about about voice? The other thing too about voice is that I'm not just looking for a unique voice. One of the things that I'm hoping for is a quiet confidence in the voice, an assuredness. If the person is trying too hard to sound literary or is trying too hard to be cute, then that's a real turnoff too. Like, the voice has to become second nature to the writer, or at least appear that way when a reader reads it. It has to seem effortless, as if this was the natural personality of the writer and you were just reading it as you're reading it and you're thinking this is the only way it could be written.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is a big sign that if the person has that quiet confidence, you can imagine that the rest of the book has, they put the work in, the plot's probably there too, or you can work on the technical stuff and the plot to get there.
Interesting.
As far as practical nonfiction goes, it's a little bit different because the experts who write practical nonfiction are not writers, so they don't have the experience and the time to develop the skill to write with great voice. So I don't judge their writing ability. What I judge is the voice of their point and the strength of their point of view.
Mm-hmm.
If they have something interesting and new to say, if they're if they're charismatic about it, if they're evangelical about it, if they appear to have the ability and also the drive to promote this their ideas or their theories, then I buy into that. And we find the ghostwriter or collaborator that captures that point of view and voice as close, as accurately as possible on the page. But I don't need it to sign those people because I assume the ghostwriter collaborator will do it for them.
Yes. Well, you have just been a wealth of information here, and I can't believe we have sped through this half hour together, but I very much appreciate you taking the time.
Oh, no problem. I just feel bad. I might not have been funny enough.
Well, I'm going to recommend that anybody who wants to hear more should go to the ASJA.org website to where the conference recordings are being sold for 2007, and look for the first pages panel. Adam was on that panel, and he was a riot, and just quite funny, and also quite generous with his information. So they can get more of you there if they want. I really would recommend that they do.
That's great. Well, thank you for having me, Barbara, and you and the ASJA have been very kind to me, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. That was Adam Cromie. He's a literary agent in New York City, and there's lots of info on his website. I am going to leave you now for a minute. I'm going to play some music while I get our next author on, Diana Abu-Jabbar. So stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. No, little darling, Rome wasn't built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The Sharp Show, featuring irreverent debates about politics, religion, and popular culture. Unscripted, with Sharp's off-the-cuff remarks occasionally provoking anger. Monday mornings, 8 to 9 a.m.
Hi, I'm attorney Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. How private is your confidential information? Who is watching you on surveillance cameras or listening in on your private phone conversations? Think of all the information you give up each day, from the fast track scans on the morning commute to the credit card purchases at Starbucks to your cell phone tracking, airline ticket, car rental records, and even the logging of PC keystrokes at work. These bits of data are shared with companies and the government to create a detailed dossier of your daily activities. How are your profiles used, and what can you do to protect yourself? We'll answer these questions and more when you listen to Privacy Piracy, Wednesday evenings from 5 to 6 p.m. at KUCI 88.9 FM or www.kuci.org.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett, on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we're also podcasting. As many of you know, we have probably 160 shows or so up on the podcast site at this point. If you go to my website, penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the page. You'll be taken to the radio page. At the top, you'll see info on how to get the podcasts. This show will most likely go up in the next 2 weeks. Usually it's about that. A couple of weeks after the program, the podcast is up. So you can listen to it all over again and take advantage of so many shows that that my podcast guru, Rob Roy, has gotten on there. Anyway, we are back with my next guest, Diana Abu Jabbar, who is the author of Crescent, Arabian Jazz, and the Language of Baklava. She grew up in Syracuse and now divides her time between Portland, Oregon, and Miami, Florida. And she's back today. She's been on a couple of times, but she's back today to talk about her most recent novel, Origin, published by Norton. Hi, Diana.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you on again. Your book was definitely a page-turner, and I so enjoyed reading it, and at the same time was cursing it because I had work to do, and I And I kept reading it and putting time into that. So thank you. And at the same time, but anyway, no, it's great. I love it when I'm reading something and I feel that I'll never find anything that I like as much.
That's great. Thank you.
It's so different from your other books. Talk about how this came about.
Wow, yeah, it was a big surprise to me. I had no intention of writing a thriller. Didn't know I had one in me. But one day I woke up and there was this very chilling sort of voice in my head, and it was the voice of Lena, the main character in Origin, and she was telling me her story about being a fingerprint detective. And I just started following it, and I knew she had this mysterious past, and she didn't know where she had come from, and she had these theories about her origins, and I just kind of, it was like I took dictation from the character, and that was what got me started on it.
Is that how your books typically begin? Does a character or a voice just start coming to you, and you start transcribing, or is it always different?
Well, I usually do have a strong sense of character when I begin writing. And, you know, I think that this is something that a lot of writers must experience, of hearing the character's voice in their head, or maybe they don't, but don't tell me if they don't. I hear these characters' voices. And this one was unusually powerful, I have to say. Origin had a really strong, potent, and very integrated voice that I'd never experienced before. Usually it's a little bit more maybe an intellectual exercise as well as an emotional one. And so with my other books, usually I start with trying to write an outline, and I try to have a clear sense of the story and where it's going to go, and this one was really a little bit different that way. Yeah.
So it's interesting, because usually with the suspense, mystery, thriller genre, so many authors really do begin with an outline and with figuring out the whole story, even from the sort of the climax of the story backward.
Yes. Yeah, that's, I love the idea of that, and I think it really speaks to my control freak,
mm-hmm.
you know? That idea that somehow you can control the material, you just have to exert your will over it, and you can, you know, bring it to submission and have that story come forth. But there's this wonderful quote, I think it's from Rilke, where he says that in order to write a book, you have to consent to lose sight of the shore for a very long time.
What a wonderful quote.
Yeah, you know, it really speaks to me. That's been my experience with every single book. I start out trying to control it and trying to do the outline, and at some point midway, I just kind of throw my hands up and say, all right, let's see where we go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So then, Lena's voice came to you, and then how much more did you need to know before you actually began writing the story?
Wow, I had such a huge learning curve. I mean, it wasn't even curved, you know, it was straight up in the air. I didn't know anything. It was terrible, really, and I don't like to work. I mean, I'm a big sluggard, and I realized that I was going to have to do a lot of research, so that was just awful for me. And I started to collect books on forensic investigation and fingerprinting. I actually bought a junior fingerprinting kit. I fingerprinted my husband. So he can't get away with anything now. And, you know, I just kind of immersed myself in it, and then I started interviewing people, and that was a new experience for me. We actually went up to the crime lab in Syracuse and spent a whole day talking with people and going through the lab, and I ended up emailing people very extensively extensively all sorts of fingerprint experts around the country about not only their work, but what it felt like to do the kind of work that they do. I really wanted to try to get it right. And so, yeah, the research probably took me as long as the actual writing of the book did.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Diana Abu-Jabbar, author of Origin, published by Norton. I wanted to ask you about, well, the voice, but also, as I know, you're rather funny, and your other work does have such humor in it, and this book is so moody, and I think someone described it as film noir. You know, it's very, it's so moody, and I found out about a whole other side of you that I didn't realize, and I wondered if it was what the experience was in maintaining sort of that moody quality, since you do seem to be rather light and funny, or is that all an act?
It's my secret self. Yes. Well, you know, it's all part of me. And I think that that's probably true for writers, that we have all sorts of characters and narratives inside of us. And that's the joy of getting to have a sort of a writing life, is that you get to try on all your different identities. I definitely wanted to do something new. And I hadn't even realized that I was starting to become known as, well, you know, the Arab food writer. I had two books in a row like that, and there you go. I actually had a number of people come up to me during my book tour and say, I don't know if I'm going to like this book. Is there any hummus in it? Yeah. There's no falafel, I don't know. So definitely people were kind of nervous about it, and some of my readers were very hesitant. For me, it was extremely exciting just to try something on that was so new and so fresh. And once I got past the tough research part of it, I found it immensely liberating, actually. Sometimes humor can have its own sort of strain, I think. And it was great to be dark and just as grumpy as I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, it felt very self-indulgent. I loved it.
Mm.
Yeah.
Will you read to us from the book?
Oh, I would be happy to.
Okay. And if you just tuned in, Diana Abu-Jabbar is about to read from Origin.
When I turn onto James Street, someone is standing on the step in front of my building, back to me. A woman, I think. The wind catches the stranger's hair, making it pulse and whip, and opens the coat into a wide billow, revealing a flash of white underneath. My eyes are tearing from the snow and wind, so it's hard to see anything. But even before she turns, I know she's looking for me. I slip into the shadow of the Glaston bus stop across the street. Snow hisses and waves against the wall of the shelter, stippling it white. I feel transparent. When I close my eyes, I step backwards into a blast of stinging snow. Up on the steps, the woman turns sharply. I hurry across James Street, and a moment later, I hear footsteps behind me. That's when some instinct spikes in me. I start running. My feet arch in my book, boots as if to grip the ice, my knees bent, head bent against the wind. There's nothing rational to this. I'm driven by a flash of terror, a sudden, unreasoning, bodily panic. I slip on the sidewalk, caught between a run and a walk. I hurry down several blocks, in and out of streetlights, through intersections. Then I duck into an alley. Inside the narrow passageway, I stumble to a stop and try to catch my breath. I can't draw enough air. The cold tightens my lungs. My eyes stream tears, which freeze along my cheeks. The alley is dark as a tunnel, narrow enough that I could stretch my arms and touch the buildings on either side. Snow has drifted in, but the alley tapers off to dry pavement in the middle. It's littered with cigarette butts and gum wrappers. There's a rumpled blanket. Just when I start to think that I've lost her, I look up and see a silhouette at the end of the alleyway, almost 20 feet away. I've crept into the dark, but she seems to be peering straight in at me. I freeze, pressed against the building. As I stare out at the distant figure, I see long hair lift in the wind, and I realize I don't know who this is. She approaches the interior. "Who's in there?" Her voice seesaws, menacing. I don't speak or move, frightened by the voice. I tell myself it's just some crazy homeless person. I take another tentative breath, and after a moment, the woman turns and moves on. I wait. After a long gawk down the alley, I step away from the wall. At that instant, the woman reappears. She takes a couple steps in as far as the light at the entrance, and she cranes toward the interior. I hear something like breath, muddled with a low gurgle. "Lena!" Her voice sings and echoes through the space. Fear-dazed, I totter backwards. "Lena!" The strange voice pulses. "Are you still with us?" She takes another step. I press my hand against the building and take a step back. I'd swear she can see me. I take another step back, trembling. "Why aren't you saving the babies, Lena?" Her voice hisses through the air, a hot blast on my skin, fingers in my hair. I blunder backwards. I shriek, stumbling into a run. I run blindly through the alley, through grids of streetlights. The world is switched on, and I run in and out of shadows, down long, cold streets, dark as coffins. I run as hard and as fast as I can.
Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
That was Diana Abu-Jabbar reading from Origin. You do such wonders with landscape in this book. The snow has never been so interesting, and I love snow, and found that you just had so many different ways of describing it and describing sort of winter in Syracuse. Yeah. Talk about that, just landscape, and how did you do that?
Well, you know, I grew up in Syracuse, and I think growing up in a place like that, it's like the Inuit, you know, they're supposed to have like thousands of words for snow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think you kind of come up in the same sort of consciousness. Snow is something that you know intimately, as well as the cold, as well as the wind, and it was something that was just such an integral part of my childhood. These winters that seem to last for 10 months, just unbroken, and I knew that I wanted to use that in some fashion to evoke that forbidding sense of menace and transformation. You know, in Syracuse, it's like the snow covers the world up, and you don't know if it's ever going to stop. And of course, Origin is also working with this theme that things are kind of out of whack in the natural world. The winter won't stop, and something is hurting these babies, and there's just a sense that everything is kind of out of kilter. So it was definitely a theme I wanted to work with in there.
Hmm. And what about the first person present tense that the book is written in, from the point of view of Lena throughout? How did you come to that?
I wanted to try first person. I think the fact that I had the mysterious voice in my head, that was so compelling. And it was almost like I could just put pen to paper and let her speak through me. So it had that kind of wonderful testimonial quality, you know, that feeling that there's nothing getting in between you and the character. And so I wanted to give her as much immediacy as I could. I do love first person, but I don't often write in first person because I think it can feel overwhelming, or it can be a little bit too sentimental. But this was such a nice, cold, you know, remote story that I think it stepped away from that. in terms of the emotional aloofness of it all. And I love writing in present tense. I've always felt like it had such a nice sense of urgency about it. So it was something that I thought would work well for a mystery.
Mm-hmm. Are there any characters in particular that you connect with or relate to?
You mean in Origin itself?
Yeah.
Well, you know, definitely Lena. She's someone who feels very close to me. But a number of the characters I'm very fond of, I mean, weirdly enough, her ex-husband, Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing sort of the platonic ideal or anti-ideal of ex-husbands there. And, you know, he's such a messed up character. He's trying to get his ex-wife back. All he ends up doing is blundering and alienating everyone. And he gets drunk and he starts fights and he's unfaithful. But there's something about him that I perversely kind of liked.
Yeah, sure. I liked him.
He's one of those bad boys, I guess, you know. And he's a cop and he's a foot soldier and... So he's sort of a mensch, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about, go ahead.
He's probably my second favorite, yeah. Mm.
What about Mr. Memdua? I don't know if I pronounced his name.
Oh, yes, right. Mr. Memdua.
Where did he come from?
Well, that's a good question. Where did he come from? He's such a big weirdo, and that was so much fun to write that character. Partly... You know, I was writing this book in the aftermath of the second presidential election.
Yes.
And I was just angry. I was just furious. I was furious with the fact that we had this, you know, this new president, well, you know, reelected, and that things didn't seem to be getting any better, and that we were seemed to be heading down the same road. And Mr. Memdua is kind of this crackpot mouthpiece for some of my own sneaky theories.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to read it closely to find the stuff that I'm embedding in there. But definitely I used his character to give myself a way to talk about all my own misgivings and rages and rants, and he was another one of those characters who let me vent all the dark side, the dark Diana.
Well, it's funny because as I was reading him, I thought, I bet this is all Diana. I bet, you know, all of this stuff. I mean, what a perfect character to give this to, but I could mm-hmm. see so much of it, you know.
Yes.
It was great.
But he's a total nut.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a total nut, but a great character.
Oh, good. Good.
Oh, we're at the end of our time. Any last words, anything you want to say to the writers listening?
Well, I want to thank all the mystery readers who have been so incredible to me. I have to tell you, it's been an absolute awakening that, you know, when you write literary novels, literary readers are very choosy, and they're difficult. And, you know, you get some of them, and they're sort of like, well, I will read your work, maybe, if you are worthy of me. And my mystery readers have been amazing. So it's been very exciting to become introduced to a whole different kind of an audience. And I want to encourage those writers out there who have maybe been thinking like they're afraid to try a new genre, or you know they feel that they have to be literary, or that genre writing isn't somehow worthy, that you can do all different kinds of stuff with your career. You know,
yeah.
You can do all kinds of different books, and you shouldn't be scared to take chances.
Mm. Yeah, the mystery readers really are a tight-knit group, and they're all over the place and so supportive. It's so true.
It's wonderful. It's one, you know, they name their children after your characters, you know.
Mm-hmm. Can you see yourself writing another thriller or suspense novel?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think there's going to be more Lena stories.
Good.
More origin stories.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I so look forward to that.
Oh, thank you, Barbara.
And appreciate your time once again for coming on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks. Thank you so much.
That was Diana Abu-Jabbar. Her latest novel is Origin, wonderful novel published by Norton. She also has a website that you can find out so much more. And I believe it's DianaAbuJabbar.com. It's Diana, AbuJabbar.com. All right, we're at the end of our time, and I'm going to leave you now with a quote by, let's do one by Woody Allen, who said, 80% of success is showing up. Yep, that pretty much works for writing, you know, you got to sit in the chair. If you'd like to know more about Writers on Writing, you can go to penonfire.com, email me from there, and you can get on the weekly email list. Thanks so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'll see you next time.